Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A few weeks ago, we did a show about whether animals should have the same rights as humans. And many of you called in with moral and philosophical questions about animal testing. So on today's Your Call, we are hosting a debate about animal testing. Millions of animals are used for testing every year in the United States to determine the toxicity of ingredients in cosmetics, bring pharmaceuticals to the market, and unlock the mysteries of many diseases. One of today's guests, Michael Kahn, says that experimentation is governed by strict rules and regulation, and there is very little pain or suffering in animal research. Michael Kahn is Senior Vice President for Research and Associate Provost at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. He's co-author of The Animal Research War, and he joins us from Texas. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show. Hello, Michael. Are you with us?
Here.
Nice to have you. And Robert Jones calls the distinction between our duties to animals and humans a false dichotomy. Robert is assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at Chico State University. He specializes in the ethics of animal cognition. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So first off, how many animals are used for testing in the United States? The numbers vary widely depending on what you read. I've read anywhere from 13 to 26 million. Michael, what does your research tell you?
Well, of the animals used, about 80, 85% are rats and mice.
Oh, I'm talking about the number first.
I can't tell you what the actual number is because many of them are not reported, but I can tell you what the makeup is.
Why aren't they reported?
Well, because you're only required to report animals for research. If people have pets, for example, those aren't reported. The USDA monitors use of animals in research, and OLAW, the Office of Laboratory Animal Welfare of the National Institutes of Health, monitors those numbers as well, and those are freely available.
Hmm.
And Rose, can I interject here?
Sure.
I think part of the reason why there's no requirement, at least at the federal level, to report the use of rats and mice and things like that is that the Animal Welfare Act does not cover rats and mice or birds or lizards.
You're absolutely right, Robert, but there's a reason for that. The Animal Welfare Act does not cover rats, mice, or birds that are purpose-bred for research. But those animals' welfare is covered by the Office of Laboratory Animal Welfare of the NIH. They're covered by ALAC, which has accreditation in many institutions around the United States. And so to duplicate that requirement at another level doesn't make a lot of sense. But the suggestion you were making that the federal government doesn't watch rats and mice and birds and lizards is just wrong.
Well, no, it is a fact that the British Animal Welfare Act doesn't include all vertebrates. It says the definition of animal, according to the British Animal Welfare Act, are vertebrates. And the U.S. Animal Welfare Act does not include all...
That's correct, but it's included under other things. And, in fact, we include cold-blooded vertebrates like fish and reptiles in the Guide for the Care and the Use of Laboratory Animals, Public Health Service.
So, I mean, based on the reports that I've read anywhere from 13 to 26 million animals. Michael, does that sound about right to you?
I wouldn't begin to guess. I mean, and don't forget, you know, they're animals and they're animals. You know, it's important to note that only a very tiny percentage, for example, are primates, in the vicinity of a tenth of 1%.
So we're talking about mostly rats and mice?
We are talking about 85% are rats and mice, somewhere in the vicinity of 10% are fish, reptiles and birds, rabbits are maybe 1%, primates are in the vicinity of a tenth of 1%. And I can tell you that between the 70s and now, animal use has virtually been cut in half. And the reason for that is scientists have developed a huge number of alternatives that we are required by law to use whenever possible.
Wait, when you say the numbers have been cut, when you say the research has been cut in half, the numbers haven't been cut. The numbers are exploding. Some people estimate that up to 500 million sentient animals are used a year. So
I'd welcome knowing who says 500 million animals.
Well, I got that figure from Larry Carbone and his book What Animals Want, and Larry Carbone actually advocates animal research. So
yes, he does, and that book is not a new book either.
So, Robert, how did he come up with that number?
Well, he came up with that number by non-official means. He had to do surveys and do estimates, and it's, you know, it's not a hard number. The point is to say that the number of animals used in research, and Michael did say there are animals and there are animals. Well, I'm not clear that a rat or a mouse, I'm distinguishing a rat or a mouse from a dog or a cat. I mean, these are still highly complex sentient beings with complex social lives. So to dismiss the numbers, the vast increase in numbers of rodents used in labs as, well, they're not the, quote, real animals.
No, you misheard me. I wasn't trying to do that at all.
Okay.
And I do think that's a point on which we agree.
Okay. Well, Michael, do you think it's important for us to know how many animals are being tested on?
Sure, and that's why the government collects these numbers, and they're available freely. I just don't happen to have them because that's not my specialty.
Michael, we're going to give you a quick call back because we're getting a hissing sound from your line. We'll call you back in just a minute. Robert, what did you think, or what are your thoughts on Robert's percentage? He said 85% of all animals are rats and mice, 10% fish, 1/10 primates.
Yeah, well, those figures are, I mean, they're a little low, but they're not way off. And I think the main issue is, one of the important issues is, we so much value primates, and they do have advanced cognitive capacities that perhaps rats and mice don't. But to make a claim that they're only using mice and rats 85%, that's to ignore the fact that they're all sentient beings, and they all have complex cognitive lives. So I don't want to make a comparison and say that it's okay to use rats, even if it's 80 or 95%. So I think the figures that Michael are giving are they're somewhat accurate, but it's, like I said, it's hard to say. And the other thing is, if rats and mice were mandated and included in the Animal Welfare Act, then there would be a mandate to have stricter accounting of numbers. So that's part of the problem.
Okay, so we'll definitely get into those questions, but I want to make sure that we're on the same page here in terms of, well, we don't know how many animals are tested, but I also want to get information about the kinds of animals that are tested.
Right.
And Michael, what else can you tell us about this? I follow this organization called the Beagle Freedom Project, and this organization works with organizations, universities that test on beagles, and then once they're done with the testing, they give the beagles to this organization, and then they find homes for them. And according to the Beagle Freedom Project, and I didn't know this, but 70,000 beagles are tested in labs in the United States because they're, quote, gentle. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, beagles are gentle animals. They're very sweet animals, and they're good models for a lot of human drugs. I've not been at a university where beagles are used, so I don't know where those numbers come from. I know industry commonly uses beagles for the reason I just mentioned. And basically what they do is they do a lot of injection of drugs, and they simply draw blood and watch the drugs metabolized. But the suggestion that you and Robert are making, that there is something intrinsically cruel about research, is one of the big lies of what goes on. We are required to subscribe to what's called the 3 R's. This is a legal requirement. We have to reduce the number of animals to the absolute minimum. We have to refine the techniques we use to reduce pain and distress to the absolute minimum. And whenever possible, and this is in stark contradiction to something you mentioned before the break, we are required to replace animals with non-animal techniques whenever we can. Research in the United States and in the United Kingdom is strictly governed by law. The law also says you have to test in animals before humans. Many diseases are almost gone from the earth. These are the triumphs of animal research. If your aunt is being treated for breast cancer, if your kids and pets are immunized, if your dad had heart surgery, if you have an artificial hip or knee, you owe a debt to animal research. Heparin, the drug that prevents strokes, is made from pig intestines. The next time you take a child to a pediatrician to diagnose flu, you're using animal products. The tests for everything from rubella to pregnancy all use materials from animals. Now, if you stop doing that, things will change.
So you brought up a lot of points there. Why don't we first talk about transparency? How transparent is animal testing?
It's transparent to the extent many research facilities, the one I was associated with in Oregon for 20 years before coming here, tours the public through. We were touring somewhere in the vicinity of 3,000 people through a year, and these were kids, these were church groups, these were anybody from the community who wanted to come through, and this was largely a primate facility. We were completely open. Our records are available. We published the results of our experiments. I don't know what more you would want in terms of transparency.
Well, I have some suggestions. So with regard to transparency, there are these bodies called Institutional Animal Care and Use Committees, which Michael's very familiar with. And these committees, they are they give the okay or the thumbs up to certain protocols when they're requested at a certain university or research facility. And there are some problems with the use care and use committees with regard to transparency. First thing is that oftentimes the committees, for the most part, are made up, are anonymous. Okay, the members aren't really, they're not part of an elected body, they're chosen by the institution. I have friends who've served on committees who've gotten overridden when they have ethical suggestions. So for the most part, the use committees in many ways are kind of rubber stamps for what the researchers
Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, for
example, in the state of Washington, let me give you a simple suggestion for transparency.
We can't have you both talking over each other because we can't hear you.
Okay.
Robert, why don't you finish your thought,
and then we'll go to Michael. Here's a suggestion for transparency, because Michael's painting this picture that if everything is squeaky clean, and whenever there's a video that appears of misuse, that's always just an aberration. I never hear the research community come out, and that's just a one-time thing. I have a suggestion. How about this? Forget about having ag gag laws. Forget about having people having infiltrate the labs. Let's spend $29 on a webcam in any lab where there are animals being used, and run the webcam, stream it on the internet, and let all uses of animals be publicly available through the internet. And so we can see what's going on in every lab. Just click on the website and see what's going on in your local lab. That would give maximal transparency, and you wouldn't have the excuse of so-called animal rights activists damaging the labs. So that would be maximal transparency. I've made this suggestion a number of times to researchers, and I get silence in response. So I don't know. That doesn't seem like an unreasonable request with regard to transparency.
Michael, what do you think?
I think that's absurd. First of all, it would create more data than anybody could possibly look at. Second, many institutions do that. In Oregon, we used to put cameras in our corrals so that people could see how the animals were and how the animals were being taken care of. This view that there's something secret going on is curious, because we used to, as I say, tour the public through. They could come, they could see what goes on. Now, it's true there are some things that the general public would not understand. But let's face it, if you went into a hospital emergency room, you'd see some pretty gross things, and you would think that's bad, but that doesn't mean an emergency room is a bad place to be.
That's a pretty bad analogy, because an emergency room is there to help patients in trauma, and a research laboratory is there to do for some of the experiments are for pure research, applied research. To say that what you witness in a hospital emergency room is hard to look at in the same way that a laboratory is, that's really a bad analogy. And secondly, I still haven't heard why it's absurd to make it fully transparent. My tax dollars are subsidizing research at, say, the UCLA, for example. Can I go down to UCLA and walk through the primate lab and see what's going on? Can I do that? I can't. I don't have access to the labs, but I do fund it through my tax dollars. So I don't see why it's absurd to say, I'm not saying videotaping. This is not videotaping. This is a $29 camera you buy at any Best Buy, and you stream. I can go on the web right now and look at the waves in Santa Monica. For $29, this is not absurd. I think this is something that should be mandated. If we're going to have animals in labs, used against their will for experiments, not all of which produce wonderful results. I think we need to make sure that they are being cared for in the best possible way. Otherwise, why would we have these videos that come out about misuse in labs and mistreatment in labs? Where is that taking place? If everything's so squeaky clean, where are those laboratories? Where do those videos crop up from?
Well, you're asking and answering a lot of questions, and I'm really not having an opportunity to go to them. So let me try to address them bit by bit. To require an institution to put cameras on animal surgery would be tantamount to putting cameras in an emergency room. So to suggest that that's a bad analogy, I believe, is wrong. Second of all, in most institutions, you would need hundreds of those video cameras, huge amounts of web space, huge amount of, it's more than $29, and it would add dramatically. I don't think that would be a television hit. I think if people want to come in and look, they're welcome to. If you want to go into UCLA, I suspect if you call the attending vet and you explain why you want to see it, they would more than likely let you in. I can tell you that we would have done that in Oregon, and as I say, we did have cameras there. To put cameras on cages of mice, I don't know what the advantage is, unless you're just trying to charge us more. I can tell you that the eyes that do look at the animals are the eyes of an attending veterinarian who is overall responsible for all of it. I can tell you the eyes of IACUC look at it. I can tell you the United States Department of Agriculture shows up randomly to look at your facility. The other question you asked is, where do all these horrible movies come from? I'll be more than happy to tell you. For the most part, they're fabricated. I went through an enormous amount of trouble after we had a circumstance in Oregon to go through with a colleague of mine and spend week after week after week of trying to figure out how images that we knew didn't exist were created. And let me just give you one example. An image was posted of an animal in a baby incubator ostensibly living in its own feces. Well, what happened was the individual who was doing the filming came in early and simply smeared some of the baby's baby food, the infant animal's baby food, on the inside, claimed it was feces, and moved on. Another example is they went into an animal room where there were about 30 or 40 animals. They frightened the animals by clapping their hands and by producing a camera, which is upsetting the animals because it looks like a human eye. The animals then huddled together. The individual took a snap and cropped it carefully. If you look in my book, The Animal Research War, we go through page after page after page of how these things were fabricated.
So what about the 2009, how about the New Iberia Research Center in Louisiana? They were charged with cruelty to chimpanzees. Is that fabricated?
I don't know because I wasn't there. Were you there?
Oh, so in order for you to know, okay. Look, this is. I don't want to reduce this to I wasn't there. The Humane Society has video, it's published on the Internet, of chimpanzees being mistreated at the New Iberian Research Center.
Okay, let's clarify what the Humane Society is. The local Humane Society is a great organization that houses animals. The Humane Society of the United States is largely a lobbying organization whose mission it is to end human use of animals in food, in research, as pets, and on and on and on.
Okay,
I don't know
what you're going to answer.
Well, let me ask you, Michael. Actually, Michael Kahn is Senior VP for Research and Associate Provost at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. He's author of The Animal Research War. He says that animal testing is governed by strict rules and regulation. There's very little pain or suffering. Robert Jones calls the distinction between our duties to animals and humans a false dichotomy. He's assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at Chico State, and he focuses on the cognitive properties that bear on the ethical treatment and moral considerability of both human and non-human animals. And today we're having a debate about animal testing. Millions of animals are used for testing In the United States, we don't have the numbers because the government does not keep these numbers. They are used to determine the toxicity of ingredients in cosmetics. We'll talk about that, bringing pharmaceuticals to the market and unlocking the mysteries of many diseases. What are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have about animal testing? Where do you stand on this issue? What philosophical and moral questions does this raise for you? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Michael, I just want to ask you, and then we'll move on from the videos, but I think this is an important point because a lot of people have access to these videos. I watched one from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, their animal research facility. Veterinarian John Young gave Americans for Medical Progress a tour of the animal lab, mice using to unlock mysteries of Down syndrome, pigs with coronary stents to treat cardiovascular disease, rats and mice for gene therapy, the dogs treating heart failure. You know, talking about how the animals are named and they're taken outside, they are allowed to walk around. And then I saw a horrific video of the PLRS, Professional Laboratory and Research Services in North Carolina, a couple of years ago. A jury indicted four individuals there for cruelty to animals. I mean, you couldn't even watch it. It was so bad. So, I mean, you know, as someone who cares about this issue, you see a video that looks nice and you see a video that's horrific. So what is the average person supposed to think when they see these two videos side by side?
Well, I do know the facility you mentioned at Cedars-Sinai. It's a first-rate facility. I don't know the other one. I can tell you that if there are bad players out there, I will be first in line to ask that they be punished for what they've done, if there are bad players, and I don't know the one in North Carolina is. I can tell you that I am an animal welfarist. I believe, as human beings, it's our responsibility to look after animals, to make sure their needs are met, to make sure if they're complex animals, their psychological needs are met. I do not believe animals have rights because I don't think they have the ability to take responsibility for their actions. I mean, the question I would ask Dr. Jones is, do you believe we should stop animals from harming other animals in the wild?
That's a very complex question, and I think we should focus back on this issue. This is an issue about predation, and that's not a discussion that I want to focus on. I want to focus on the issue that you just raised, actually.
So you don't have an answer?
I do have an answer, but it's beyond the scope of how I can answer in a minute.
Well, I don't know how to address that because fundamentally what we are doing is recognizing that animal research is valuable. The demonstration over time is it's useful. It's a trade-off. The more we learn about how to help humans, we do so to engage by way of animal experimentation. It's strictly governed by federal laws and regulations to be sure it's done as humanely as possible. Our obligation to animals is that they don't suffer or feel pain. Our obligation to people is that we respect their right to be self-directing within the context of society. I assume you're an animal welfarist as well.
I want to focus on something that you said.
You know, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll get back to this right after the break. We'll talk about the products, what everyday products are tested on animals. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about cosmetics testing. And then a few people are calling in asking, if we've got so many technological advances, why are we still testing on animals? So we'll also address that question with Michael Kahn, Senior Vice President for Research and Associate Provost at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, and Robert Jones, Assistant Professor in the Department of Philosophy at Chico State. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
This is your call on KALW San Francisco, local public radio. We invite you to join today's conversation. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We'd love to hear from new people joining the program. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say. Following that at 12 noon today, it's Backstory.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the recent teacher tenure decision in California. A California judge ruled against the state's union-backed teacher tenure laws. So what are the implications of this ruling? How could axing tenure and seniority change the quality of education in California? We'll also talk about who bankrolled this case. That's tomorrow. On Wednesday, are we overusing antibiotics? They've saved countless lives, but they're growing less and less effective as antibiotic resistant strains of bacteria are popping up. So many people are taking antibiotics. That's Wednesday. And then Thursday, how are colleges dealing with rape and sexual assault, and how should they? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are focusing on animal testing. Millions of animals are used for testing every year in the United States. According to reports, the numbers vary from 13 to 26 million, but we don't know because we don't record the number of animals that are used for testing. And so what are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have? What are your thoughts about animal testing? What moral and philosophical questions does this raise for you? If you work in this field, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Michael Kahn is Senior Vice President for Research and Associate Provost at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. He's co-author of The Animal Research War. He says that experimentation is governed by strict rules and there's very little pain or suffering in animal research. Robert Jones disagrees. He is assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at Chico State. He specializes in the ethics of animal cognition. And Robert and Michael, we've got full lines and a lot of emails, so why don't we take a few calls and then we'll get responses from you both. Let's hear from Christy in San Francisco. Hi, Christy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
I work for a medical device company in the regulatory department. We make class 2 low-risk surgical devices, and we are often required to repeat biocompatibility testing on devices by the FDA to get approval that have known biocompatible materials. We're talking about plastics and polymers that have been used for decades in medical devices. We use a reputable lab. I believe that they treat the animals well, but for me, it's always really sad that we're required to keep testing materials everyone knows are safe on rabbits and guinea pigs.
Hmm. How often do you have to do this?
Well, they usually require you to reevaluate your biocompatibility. If you make any change in the sterilization, if you change to a different manufacturer or a different supplier, even if it's the same class of material, it's very, very difficult to provide a justification for not repeating your biocompatibility. That's my experience, and I find it very frustrating because I feel that it's a waste of animals' lives. Even if I don't have anything per se against animal testing, I believe it's necessary sometimes, but I hate treating animals' lives like, you know, they're just not worth anything.
Well, thank you for calling. Michael, what are your thoughts on this, and how common is this practice?
Well, I don't know specifically how common what she's referring to is, but as I've mentioned a couple of times, the 3 R's require that you reduce the number of animals to the minimum possible. And if there's an opportunity here to do that, Christy needs to speak with her USDA representative. If a law needs to be changed in order to accommodate that, that's the way to approach it. One thing I want to mention, since you've mentioned my institutional affiliation a number of times, is that I'm not representing my institution. These are my own views.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. Robert, do you have any comments on Christy's call?
I do. I think a lot of these experiments are duplicated for legal reasons, not because of knowledge, gaining knowledge. I'll give you an example of something that's currently going on at the University of Wisconsin, maternal deprivation studies on macaque monkeys. So we've already had this research done by Harlow in the 50s. If you many of us remember seeing films of the little baby monkey being removed from the mother. Well, that's being duplicated again today. And do we really need to take macaque monkeys newborn macaque monkeys, remove them from their mothers to determine that removing a primate from its mother causes disturbances and psychological disruptions? Is that the kind of research that our tax dollars
again,
want to fund?
Again, Robert, the IACUC is responsible for reviewing things for redundancy. If there is a reality that anywhere is doing something that's redundant or not necessary, please take that up with their IACUC.
Michael,
sure
I will, but you seem to have a lot of faith in the IACUC, and there's no room on your view that maybe the IACUC is a part of a rubber-stamping organization. They're okaying these experiments. They're not really that critical of any kind of ethical objections to these kinds of experiments.
Well, what is the IACUC?
That stands for Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee. It's a group of people who review research protocols on animals. In the same way, institutions have committees that review research protocols on humans. The IACUC also includes a community member, so you bring in someone from the outside. Robert, I'm curious to know, where was the last animal research facility you visited?
I haven't visited a research facility recently.
And yet you have some pretty amazing views.
Okay. Well, you can do, if you want to attack me personally and not stick to the issue, let me ask the audience a question. Do you think that your tax dollars need to fund whether removing baby macaque monkeys from their mothers is bad for them? So I'll just put that out for the audience. Forget what Michael thinks. Forget what the IACUC thinks. This is the kind of research that's being funded by your tax dollars. So I'll leave common sense to answer that question.
Robert, that wasn't meant to be a personal attack. I was simply evaluating your ability to be authoritative on this subject.
Well, I'm authoritative on the ethics of the treatment of animals, if you want to talk about that. And I would like to mention something you did say. Let me ask you a question, Michael. You said that you believe that we shouldn't, animals have their place and they don't have this kind of autonomy. Let's take a human being who has the exact same capacities as, say, I don't know, a dog. Okay, the same cognitive capacities, an orphan human being. Let's take that human being. Michael, would you be willing to experiment on that human being, even given the benefits were going to be great?
I never used the word autonomy, and maybe you could clarify that question.
The question is, let me ask you this. We use animals for experimentation, and we don't use human beings. And you advocate for that.
We do use human beings for experimentation.
But not for non-consensual, invasive biomedical experimentation. We do not use human beings non-consensually. There is an ugly history that goes back to Tuskegee. There's a lot of history of biomedical experiments being done on oppressed peoples. So there is a history.
And you and I don't support that, right?
Do you know about the Tuskegee experiment?
Absolutely. I say you and I do not support that.
Okay, we don't support that. My point, here's what I'm trying to get at. My point, Michael, is that you're claiming that, I don't want to say what you're claiming. Why is it that you feel that it's okay to experiment on animals, but not okay to non-consensually experiment on humans who, let's say, are at the same cognitive capacity of an animal? Why is that not okay with you?
Well, if you're talking about the standard argument where people compare...
Yes, I am. The argument from marginal cases. Yeah. What's your response to that?
If you're talking about the standard argument where people compare a monkey to an anencephalic child, is that
mm-hmm.
what you're talking about? The difference many people seem to be missing is that the monkey is a normal state. The child is a tragedy. That's why they're different.
But that's not the question. Would you experiment on the child? Were there to be benefits produced through the experimentation?
Well, I can tell you that under compassionate care, it's possible for people with consent and with heavy oversight to, in near-death situations, experiment on humans. I'm not sure I know what would come of the experiment you're suggesting, and it frankly strikes me as being immoral.
That's the point. The point of the question is, if it's immoral, it can't be the fact that humans are humans and animals are... There's something going on that's driving the belief that it's okay to experiment on animals. It's okay because they're animals. That's what I think is the case of speciesism. It's just like racism and sexism.
Well, I know that word human, is often...
This is a case of human exceptionalism, that humans have the right to do what they deem is correct as long as it benefits humans, regardless of the consequences for, in this case, non-human animals.
That is Robert Jones. He's assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at Chico State. Michael Kahn is senior vice president for research at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. He's speaking here in his own capacity. These are his own views. He's not representing the university today. And we're having a debate about animal testing. We've got a number of calls and emails. So I want to go through a few and then we'll get responses. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What are some of the philosophical and moral questions this raises for you if you work, like Christy earlier, in an industry that does test on animals? We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this issue? Let's go next to Michael in Cincinnati. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
We're having this program on today. Speaking as someone who was trained inside a laboratory, I think Mr. Kahn is being rather disingenuous with some of the information he's giving you today. The picture that he's portraying as to how regulated animal laboratories are is really very misleading because, for example, the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee in laboratories can set aside virtually every requirement of the Animal Welfare Act, anything from how often the animals are fed or given water to whether or not they're even given whether they're given pain relief as a part of highly invasive experimentation. In fact, this happens so often that on the animal use report forms, there's an entirely separate column, which is referred to as column E, which is for reporting the use of animals in painful or stressful experimentation without benefit of anesthesia. And the other thing that is being ignored here is that a lot of faith, as I think someone mentioned, is being put in these animal care committees. And the thing that's being ignored is that, with the exception of that lone community representative, everyone else on that committee is usually employed by the university, which profits substantially from the performance of animal experimentation. And so they have a very serious vested interest in making sure as much animal experimentation as possible happens.
Michael, can I ask you a quick question? Because you brought up a number of points. What kind of lab were you trained
evaluation.
In? Michael, can you hear me?
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you, because you're raising a number of points there. What kind of lab were you trained in?
I was trained in the animal laboratories at the University of Cincinnati.
Okay. And then talk a little bit more about the profit side of this, because we haven't talked about that yet.
Well, nationally in the U.S. every year, the federal government funds animal experimentation somewhere to the point of roughly $12 to $14 billion a year. And there are a number of specific laboratories in the U.S. that, by our estimates, bring in something on the order of, say, maybe $100 million a year for performing animal experiments. And so the reality is that there's a very real profit motive here for these laboratories to continue to do animal experimentation. And in fact, as I was starting to bring up a few years ago, a comparative study was done by authors by the name of Plaus and Herzog, who looked at the approval of experiments by animal care committees, such that when the vested interest of the fact of having the experimentation going on in your own facility was removed, approximately half of the projects which had been approved by other animal care committees were not approved by ones from other universities. And what that's demonstrating is that there is a real profit motive here. One of the other things that Dr. Kahn brought up was talking about the humane use of animals in laboratories. And if you look at, for example, non-human primates, macaque monkeys, which I believe that species was brought up, in their natural habitat, macaque monkeys may cover as much as a square mile of territory in a given day. And that's a very stark contrast to the laboratory cages that these animals are kept in, which can be most instances, just a few feet in any one direction. The reality that you can keep an animal that's very social by nature and covers a very large ranging habitat in their natural setting in what is essentially a stainless steel box and call that humane is ludicrous. That's why...
All right. Well, Michael, thank you for calling. We have a number of callers on the line, and I want to get to as many as we can. We'll get to your questions and comments about profit and the humane use of these animals in just a minute. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Alka in Washington, D.C. Hi, Alka. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for covering this important topic. I actually would love to pick up where the other caller left off on the issue of IACUC approval rates, the approval rates of oversight committees. That's absolutely correct, and other studies have found similar similar data regarding the fact that IACUCs, these oversight committees, basically serve as rubber stamping committees. In fact, I work at PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and we did some research looking at the leading universities that are receiving federal funds for animal experimentation and found that the IACUCs, the oversight committees at those facilities, are dominated by animal experimentation interests. The numbers are that, well, for the chairs, it's 98% are themselves vivisectors or animal experimenters. And then for the rank and file of these committees, we're talking about over 80% of the membership is comprised of animal experimenters and veterinarians who perform animal experiments. So we're talking about a real vested interest to approve. There are political issues here as well. And, you know, people can say, you know, somebody like Michael Kahn can say that there should be more experimenters on the committee. But we see in government reports about how well the minimal federal regulations are enforced and are abided by in these facilities, we're seeing that the minimum things are not being done and the oversight committees are falling down on their jobs, allowing absolutely hideous experiments to take place, lack of search for alternatives. That's like the biggest problem in laboratories right now.
Hmm. Do you mean alternatives in using technology instead of animals?
Yeah, or even things like making sure that the minimum number of animals is being used.
Well, you know what? Since we're almost at the end of the show, what are some alternatives that a group like PETA would advocate for? Did I lose you?
Can I answer that question?
Yes, Michael. Michael Kahn.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I prefer not to take marching orders from PETA. There's a great website called PETAKillsAnimals.com, and it publishes PETA's own records showing that in 2013, they killed 82% of the pet animals entrusted to their care. People need to look at that. Now, there are lots of animal alternatives, and what I think people might find interesting is that these animal alternatives were developed by the scientists, not by animal rightists. Sometimes we use cell culture. For example, my own lab uses lots of cell cultures. We don't presently use any animals. Believe me, animals are difficult to use. They're hard to reproduce. Cell cultures are a lot cleaner and a lot more pleasant. There are many people sometimes use epidemiology for studies. People use tissue cultures that may have been derived from an animal that was killed for another purpose. I want to emphasize that these alternatives that were developed by the scientists themselves are something we do regularly and which we're required by law to do.
Can you talk about more alternatives? As we have, I mean, a lot of people are calling in about this, technological advances. Why are we still using so many animals for testing? And I mean, what changes are you seeing with technological advances?
Well, less and less animals are used every year. And there is absolutely no question that as we develop genetic engineering tools, which my own lab uses, that a lot of the things that we're doing today will become unnecessary. We can do a lot of work on what's called chips. We hybridize molecules on chips, and it's possible to do things that relieve the need for animals. Something that all scientists want to do, all researchers want to do. The concept that people are doing this for profit is absolutely crazy. When I lecture in the community, I have a photo of the faculty parking lot showing the cars that we own. if we're in this for profit, we're making a big mistake. I mean, we can't possibly be.
Robert, before we talk about profit, can you talk about alternatives?
Well, I mean, as Michael mentioned, there's chip, there's chip simulation, there's computer models. Let me just say something in response to what Michael said. It's true that these alternative models are produced by the researchers. I'm wondering, why are they producing them because they're concerned about animal welfare, or is there a profit motive in getting rid of the animals?
No, Robert, things get better with time. Today,
right.
Research in animal care is much better than it was 50 years ago. Public schools, better than they were 50 years ago. Hospitals, better than they were 50 years ago. It's the nature of humanity to want to improve things.
Michael, and one other thing I want to correct, I really want to get this straight. You keep emphasizing that the number of animals used is on the decline. That's just false. If you count rats and mice, the numbers are exploding. So to say that over time the numbers are dwindling, that's just false.
Well,
the numbers of
non-rodents
is dwindling. This is true.
I can tell you, for example, that we are trying at this point to avoid almost any use of chimpanzees. I believe there's less than 50 now in the United States, whereas years ago there were hundreds.
The Institute of Medicine advised the NIH to cease using chimpanzees, right? To recommend to cease using chimpanzees.
Yeah, I think we're saying the same thing.
Right, chimpanzees.
Yes.
Okay.
What else can you tell us about alternatives, Robert? I mean, I don't. If you're saying that the number of animals is increasing, we don't even have these numbers. So where are you getting that research?
Where am I getting the numbers are increasing?
Yes.
Like I said, I'm various sources like Larry Carbone's, but these you have to piecemeal these numbers together through various sources to try to figure out what the numbers of rats and mice are in laboratories being used, because they don't have to be accounted for. So you have to piecemeal these numbers. There's no one source to go to that says this is how many rats and mice are being used in laboratories. It's not federally mandated to account.
What about the some of the moral and ethical questions? I mean, we have a lot of emails. One listener, Dolores, says, UCSF right here in San Francisco was fined a couple of years ago for its cruelty to lab animals. That is the truth. This is an ethical and moral issue. The public is prohibited at UCSF to go on any floor where animals are being tested. Michael, what are your thoughts on the ethical and moral questions that this issue raises?
I think you can get a lot of really good guidance from the Dalai Lama. He is spoken extensively on how humanity treats animals. At a neuroscience meeting some years ago, he said, in talking about animal research, he said, treat them respectfully. Do not exploit them. In the immediate term, you may lose something, but in the long run, you gain much good. It is a difficult question. I encourage the minimum use of experiments on animals, the absolute minimum of pain, only perform highly necessary experiments with as little pain as possible. And that, Rose, is exactly what we do.
So then you're claiming, Michael, that you use the words necessary. So you're saying that all the experiments that use animals are necessary. So all the uses of animals are necessary.
Yeah, it has to pass that standard at a number of levels, including the IACUC, including the NIH, including the Office of Laboratory Animal Welfare.
Right.
You can't do things that are redundant. You must do things, and you must explain that you're not repeating something, and you must explain that there is no better way to do it. You're required to do literature searches to demonstrate that. You're required to tell the IACUC what the words you used in your search were. Sometimes the IACUC will go back and repeat things, find things, make suggestions, and it's a back-and-forth process. I can tell you, having been through IACUC many times back in the years when I used mice, it is an extremely difficult process to get something through an IACUC committee. The concept that IACUC rubber stamps is just factually without basis.
And Robert, same question to you. We've got about a minute left. What are the main moral and ethical questions this issue raises for you?
The main issue that's raised to me is that human beings assume we assume a kind of speciesism that we have the moral entitlement to use animals as we see fit as long as it benefits human beings. I think that's the crux. That's the mistake that's being made here. The animals are not ours to use as we please. They have their own lives. They have their own social networks. They have all this these capabilities that we ignore when we use them for our own interests.
And where do you see this going as we are? I mean, there's a bill to end cosmetic testing, for example, on animals. It was introduced in Congress in March. H.R. 4148 would make it unlawful for anyone to conduct or commission cosmetic animal testing in the United States. So, Michael Kahn, this bill is getting some traction on both sides of the aisle.
You know, I'll tell you, Rose, I can get along without eyeshadow. I can't get along without immunization.
Robert?
Hey, I think immunization, this is kind of what I call the shotgun approach. If you do enough experiments on enough animals with for as varied amount of medications and various procedures, something's going to work. So I'm not here denying that immunizations don't work. That's not the point. My point is that the use of animals assumes a certain moral superiority that I just think is not justified. It's not warranted.
Robert Jones is assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at Chico State. He specializes in the ethics of animal cognition. And Michael Kahn is senior VP for research at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. He's co-author of The Animal Research War. He's here representing his own views, not the Texas Tech University. Michael and Robert, thank you so much for joining
thanks
us.
So much. Thanks for your help, everyone.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What do you want to know about the recent teacher tenure decision in California? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about a California judge's ruling against the state's union-backed teacher tenure laws. What are the state and national implications of this ruling? Who bankrolled this case? And how could axing tenure and seniority change the quality of education in California? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.